Good morning.
Good morning. Sorry for the delay. I figured out what was wrong with my headphones last week and I ordered a new cord and it's too short. So back to the drawing board. Problems. Amazon return. All right. We just have one question today, so we'll go ahead and get started. And then any questions from you two are welcomed. Okay, so this was a follow-up. Tracy, you asked a question a couple weeks ago on emulsifiers and the gut. How do they affect the gut? So many of the studies, I'll caveat my answer by saying that many of them are in animals. So we'll focus on what human studies we have in this case. And the results may depend on the model used in the human studies. Not all emulsifiers are created equal as well. So this study here was recently published last year, the direct impact of commonly used dietary emulsifiers on human gut microbiota. This one was quite comprehensive, actually. They took fecal samples from healthy individuals, and then they treated the samples over the course of 6 days with 20 different common emulsifiers and food additives. And they definitely found some evidence that some of the emulsifiers, two in particular, were the worst. The synthetic emulsifiers, carboxymethylcellulose and polysorbate 80, do impact the gut microbiome or gut microbiota composition and function. And there were other potentially problematic emulsifiers that they found. So propylene glycol alginate, kappa carrageenan, Arabic gum, xanthan gum, guar gum, locust bean gum, glycerol stearate, sorbitan monostearate, rhamnolipids, sporolipids. We can put all these in the list in the show notes. It's also in this paper here, obviously. And also maltodextrin, which isn't really a emulsifier per se, but it's more of a texture enhancer. So many of them, but not all of them, led to decreased microbial diversity in the gut, or at least a significant change in microbial composition in what's probably a negative direction, but it's hard to say for sure, just because we're still at our infancy of knowing really what, you know, a healthy gut microbiome looks like. The impact on the diversity of the gut microbes likely leads to a shift in gut function, particularly the ability of the gut microbiome to modulate inflammation in a positive or negative way. Certain emulsifiers were shown to increase the expression of microbiome-derived pro-inflammatory molecules like lipopolysaccharide and flagellin. The two in particular that were the worst here were that carboxymethylcellulose and polysorbate 80. There's also some suggestion that some emulsifiers can significantly reduce butyrate production in the gut through what is likely a change in butyrate-producing beneficial species and a general shift toward dysbiosis. And some of the changes were seemingly reversible in the time frame that they looked at. Others were not, at least for the duration of the study. And for lethicin, that's a pretty common emulsifier. I believe they looked at soy lethicin in this paper and another one. The jury seems to be still out for that one. It seems to be a less worse offender, but probably not completely innocent. There's also preliminary evidence to suggest that some additives in the emulsifiers may disrupt the mucosal barrier of the gut, which would allow for enhanced bacterial translocation from the gut into the bloodstream and thus cause inflammation. So there's definitely some significant effects on emulsifiers on the gut microbiome. And it's probably really only an issue, I would think, if you're consuming these foods on a regular basis versus just every once in a while. Definitely something to watch out for in ingredient lists. And that's just another reason to, you know, opt for the whole foods versus packaged foods. Okay. So that was the only question for this week. So ladies, anything from you on this topic or other topics, please feel free.
So I have a question about butyrate. I know that we've talked about butyrate before, and I was taking butyrate as a supplement. I heard a podcast, and I was on vacation, so I don't recall every detail of it, but it was an NBT podcast that was talking about butyrate. And the speaker who was being interviewed referenced certain people who butyrate might be negative, for whom it might negatively impact your gut. I can't recall now, I'm sitting here, under what scenario they said that might occur, but I know that I was taking butyrate recently, and I've had some, you know, thyroid issues, as you know, kind of resurface. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of timing it back. And I don't know that it has anything to do with butyrate. I don't know if that's anything to do with the fact that I started supplementing with it just a little while ago, but because it was one of the factors I had changed, I stepped off of taking it for a little while, because I'm not sure if I'm one of those people who might be negatively affected by it. But do you know sort of under what circumstances people should not supplement with butyrate?
Yeah. So it's hard to say, because the butyrate supplementation literature is still in its infancy. And a lot of the studies are positive, but from a clinical perspective, a lot of the times butyrate is better for kind of that diarrhea end of the spectrum versus the constipated side of the spectrum. So if it leads to or exacerbates constipation, I would say that's probably not a great thing. And in theory, that could impact thyroid if, you know, you're not detoxifying or eliminating toxins through your stool because you're constipated, and those toxins then have a more detrimental impact on the thyroid because they're not getting excreted. That's kind of, it's a little bit of a stretch, but that could certainly be. I don't know if you found any differences in the consistency or quality of your stool. I don't know of any literature, and I don't remember hearing anyone talking about particular detrimental effects on thyroid function of supplemental butyrate. Mm-hmm. But it really, I would say, do you remember if you did have a test looking at your butyrate levels, right?
Yes. Were they low? I was told to supplement with it. Yes. It said like central problem as one of my issues, but I just hadn't been supplementing with it. And so I don't know that there's any correlation between the two. I just know that it was one of the two things I had changed recently, was that was one of them. And so before I had heard the podcast, I just decided to stop it. Then I heard the podcast while on vacation, and I thought, oh, well, I wonder if there is some connection between the fact that I was taking it. But I know it's good for you. I've heard a lot of NBT podcasts that talk about how beneficial it is to have, not necessarily supplement with butyrate, but how important butyrate is, whether it's foods that increase your butyrate or actually just having a healthy balance of butyrate. And so I was contemplating whether or not to go back on it, but I wanted to first make sure that I didn't fall into a category that very clearly should not be taking butyrate.
Yeah, I would say no. It's certainly possible that it did something that shifted some of your symptoms in a negative direction. So what I would say is, stay off of it. I don't know how long you've been off of it, but I would say a good probably 2 weeks or so, and then consider adding it back. I don't remember how much you were taking, because that's not one that we recommended, but I would start with the lowest dose. So just a capsule, and like slowly work up to the prescribed dose. Okay. And, then watch symptoms. So that's probably the best way to know for sure. And the other option would be to say, okay, like let's get some of these thyroid symptoms under control as best we can first, and then add it back to see if there's any correlation there.
Okay.
How do you test for butyrate?
A stool test.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's looking, it's the best option we have. I believe you can test for butyrate in blood as well, but stool would be, you would at least, there's some suggestion that stool butyrate or fecal butyrate is a good proxy for colonic butyrate. And that's where the butyrate producers live, in your gut. So there is some kind of debate around, are we talking like generalized colonic butyrate production? Is that a good proxy, or is fecal butyrate a good proxy for that? Or is it really only looking at that last part of your large intestine when it comes to the butyrate in your stool sample versus up higher in the large intestine? And that's the same with all stool tests, right? So we can only get a certain type of sample. But that's the best that I know of that we have is fecal butyrate levels in the stool test.
Okay.
Can I ask a different question about electrolytes?
Mm-hmm.
Again, I've heard a lot about the benefits of drinking electrolytes or supplementing with electrolytes or adding salt to your water. And I'm doing the LMT supplement that you guys had suggested. And I was trying to get my husband to drink it. And he was like, he has high blood pressure. So he was asking, do you know what the studies are or what the research is about people who have high blood pressure drinking that electrolyte water? Because I know the sodium content is very high.
Right. Yeah. So it's a little bit complicated. There's a couple of things I would say. One is some people are salt sensitive when it comes to blood pressure. Some people aren't. So mm-hmm. the only way to really know if he is one of those people is, some people it's more like a chronic load of stress that increases blood pressure. For some people, it could be kind of gut microbiome. For others, it could be related to nitric oxide. For others, it may be related to salt in the diet. I would say if he has high blood pressure and he's already eating a decent amount of dietary salt, then probably, unless he's doing a ton of sweating, it may not be worth him adding more salt in. That said, he could certainly try. And the other thing that I'd be thinking about would be sodium potassium balance. So I don't know how many vegetables he eats, but vegetables, balancing potassium from vegetables and plants and sodium from salts is important for blood pressure, that balance of sodium potassium, more so even than just your overall sodium intake, and then general fluid intake as well. So, I would, before being concerned about salt, I would try to say, okay, let's balance the sodium potassium ratio, make sure that he's getting enough plants in his diet. And then secondary to that, look at the general fluid intake. And he can certainly try the element. I don't know if you have a home blood pressure cuff, but that would be an easy way to monitor, have him drink it. And maybe it's kind of spreading it out over the course of the day versus in one concentrated glass type of thing. But I think it's totally safe to play with. And it's interesting with cardiovascular issues, there seems to be a U-shaped curve, not just blood pressure, but generally speaking, with sodium. So too little can be problematic, but too much can also be problematic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it normal? At some point I noticed certain foods just yesterday, actually not every day, but I've been drinking the water for about 2 weeks, tasted very salty. But I'm kind of drinking it throughout the day too. Is that normal?
The water tasted salty or certain foods?
No, certain foods. Like I took a stick of beef jerky that I eat all the time and it tasted super salty yesterday.
Oh, okay. So that might be, and I don't know if there's actually any science backing this up, but there is some suggestion that when you're depleted in sodium, then you won't taste things as super salty because your body wants more. So it's just kind of like this natural mechanism. And then when you have enough sodium, we're talking about within the course of a couple of hours or over the course of the day, then you might start perceiving different foods as more salty, as kind of like a turn off mechanism. So you may not actually need that much salt. So what you could do is cut the element in half. You might also and spread it out over the course of the day. The other thing to think about would be, if you are, having a lot of salt at once, that might also, if it's beef jerky with an element, with a can of sardines, with, some salty something else, that might also kind of be a turnoff as well, but that would maybe suggest to me that you might not need that much.
I probably need it when I work out and I sweat a lot, but as it turns out, I was lucky enough to get COVID while on vacation.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. And so I'm not working out for the past week. And so normally I think it would balance out with the amount that I would sweat, but it might be that because now that you mentioned that I just am not, losing enough to restore with that one packet that I would normally be doing.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
A lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's it.
I hope COVID is short-lived for you. I'm sorry.
You know, it was, that's okay. You know, on all these years, it's the first time I've gotten it, so I can't complain. And my whole family got it. My kids are doing fine.
Until now. Yeah.
It's like, oh, this is what everyone's been talking about. We've all been okay. My kids got over it within like 2 days. And,
oh, good. Good.
Same. My husband and I have been fine. I took it the hardest, I think, and I'm fine. I'm fine. I haven't scheduled an appointment because it makes no sense until I can kind of get back to normal.
Sometimes it's almost like a relief. Got it. No, I can move on with life. Hopefully you have some kind of lasting natural immunity.
Yeah. And it's an extended vacation from work. So I got back from vacation and now I can't go back to work. So we're all stuck here watching movies. I can't complain. It's gnarly. It is gnarly.
So last week, Megan, you talked about vaginal microbiome and, you know, mm-hmm. not being good to have too much diversity there, which I knew. And one thing to try was a probiotic. Is there anything else, diet, lifestyle, like anything else? What impacts the vaginal microbiome?
There's a lot. We actually, Chris and I did a whole podcast on it a while back that we can link to in the show notes. But let's see what else. There is some suggestion that there could be a link between gut and vaginal microbiome to some extent, where there's dysbiosis in the gut there that could kind of lead to dysbiosis in the for the vaginal microbiome. Tampons can certainly do it. Using tampons, the time of the month. So when you menstruate, oftentimes after that, whether it's because of what you're using when you are bleeding or whether it's because of something else that's going on, some people find that things like yeast infections and bacterial vaginosis or vaginitis kind of pop up after their period. So there does seem to be some kind of like, and that could also be related to hormones. Estrogen definitely seems to have an impact, a positive impact on the gut microbiome, which is why we see in those kind of perimenopause years, there seems to be, a concurrent shift in lower estrogen and also worse or more bacterial diversity for the vaginal microbiome. Intercourse can cause changes in the vaginal microbiome for some people. Trying to think of what else we talked about on the podcast. Let me see if I can pull up my notes. We can link to the podcast in the show notes as well, but let me just see. So here's my, it's been a while since I've looked at this, but here's my outline. There we go. So we can also link to this outline in the show notes. Causes of disruptions to the vaginal microbiome. We talked about menses, gut dysbiosis. We don't know if that's actually true, but diet, there may be some correlation between things like vitamin D, iron deficiencies, certain types of dietary patterns, glycemic load. Let's see, contraceptives, and that could be either oral or IUDs, antibiotics, general hygiene practices, stress, tampons, lubricants, Oh, and then also the big one for some people is like, you know, your typical vaginal hygiene or cleansing products, whether they're wipes or sprays or deodorants or powders. Those can definitely have a negative effect as well. And even some soaps, depending on how you're washing, can sometimes shift the vaginal microbiome into a kind of a negative direction. To some extent, it should be self-cleaning. So those would be the things that I would be thinking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Of course.
I will probably go back and listen to that podcast.
Yeah. It was, I didn't know much about it before and I learned a lot doing it. So
it's good.
It's an interesting topic.
Last week I talked some too about a concern with being underweight and continuing to kind of trickle down and lose weight. What are your concerns or what is known about maybe at this perimenopausal age of long-term being underweight, like under 100 pounds at 5'7" and now that it's been going on several months.
Yeah.
Being underweight, never, ever having been an issue before. Like this is kind of a change.
As far as like long-term risks or.
Right. Right.
I would be thinking about, number one, bone health, bone density, general, you know, muscle mass. If you're losing weight, you're probably not just losing fat. You're probably losing a combination of fat and muscle.
Yeah.
And you know, if your diet's good and you're also doing, you know, some exercise, some strength training, you're probably skewing that a little bit toward fat versus muscle, but certainly you don't just lose fat when you lose weight, whether it's intentionally or unintentionally. The other thing I would be thinking about is the effects of hormones. So usually when you're at a low body weight, your body, especially, you know, regardless of where you are in life, especially if you haven't gone through menopause yet, a lower body weight is a signal to your body to not produce estrogen, progesterone. These hormones that we know are important for brain health, for bone health, for basically everything. So those would be the top things. And under the hormonal umbrella, there's obviously a lot there. But those would be the top concerns that I would have off the top of my head.
Okay.
Yeah. And just the general sign that's, you know, that's a red flag for something occurring, right? That's probably pathological to some extent.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's been mostly the concern is just figuring out why is this happening? Is it really not enough calories? And I'm trying to consciously, you know, ramp that up and do the strength training.
Yeah. Have you, you'll have to remind me because I don't remember off the top of my head. Have we tested a thyroid for you? Like a comprehensive panel?
Yes, I think so. I mean, we've tested thyroid and whether it was a comprehensive panel, it was T3, T4, and TSH. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
T3 and T4 were each a little low, not off the charts. And they actually, within a 2-week period, they were both even out of like the standard from my doctor's office. They were both below the norm from there. And then a couple of weeks later though, they had both went up a little bit so that I think 4 was with on the low normal and 3 was still below. They were both still lower than what, you know, NBT says is ideal.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that there was no hyperthyroidism going on. It doesn't sound like that's the case unless you're kind of swinging. And some people do swing. There are some conditions that can cause you to swing. I'm just trying to think. Do you remember when about it started? Was it around the time of AIP? Do you feel like that kind of set it off? Or
weight loss?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, over the last couple of years, 2.5 years or so, like what led me to eventually get to AIP and trying to figure out the gut issues, you know, one of the concerns and the changes was some unintentional weight loss from 120 to 125 to about 12, I think is what I was when I started AIP. So over a couple year period, you know, 10 to 15 pounds without trying. And when, you know, I didn't feel like I had, I feel like I was at a healthy weight, but I didn't need to lose any. So that was a big chunk. And then from January 1st, where I was 112 and started AIP, to now where I'm 97, 98, 99, another big chunk in just about 6 months. And during the AIP portion, I guess it didn't, it, in hindsight, it didn't, doesn't surprise me that much. I didn't go into it thinking I was going to lose a bunch of weight, but thinking of how restrictive that was. And but then adding back in, I mean, I'm not really doing much gluten and dairy, but I don't feel like I'm restrictive right now. And I'm really paying attention to calorie consumption.
And with AIP, some, for some people, it causes weight loss because it's restrictive. For other people, because it's reducing inflammation, it can help them gain some needed weight. What was I going to say? Oh, yes. Have you had a colonoscopy before?
Yes. I've had a few in my life, but in May of 2020.
Okay.
So 2 years.
And the weight loss started before that?
Weight loss started before that. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That would be the other thing off the top of my head, but I'll keep thinking about other things we could explore. You don't know other symptoms, like you're not feeling like your metabolism is going overtime. Like you're not hot, you're not sweating, you're not waking up in the middle of the night really warm. Hair is it, I guess hair falling out could go both hypo or hyper metabolism. None of that.
No. And day to day energy is fine. I do feel, I have had some muscle loss, I'm almost sure. And I do feel the impacts in exercising. I fatigue quicker.
Okay.
But I don't necessarily feel fatigued day to day. And I sometimes wake up warm in the middle of the night, but I don't think that's a change. It's anything drastic.
Yeah. Okay. And it would probably not just be concentrated to the middle of the night. It would be just like generally feeling more hot than others during the day.
No, I'm always cold.
Pretend. Okay.
And this year, this winter was, I mean, I've always been a cold person and, you know, have Raynaud's, and Raynaud's has gotten worse over the past few years. And this year in particular was probably the worst I've had yet for Raynaud's and for feeling cold just throughout the day, most of the winter. Even, I mean, I'm still wearing a base layer and sitting here with a blanket on just because it's more comfortable that way.
Yeah. And that could be, you know, especially now with the weight loss, that could be due just to not having as much extra insulation on your body, right? Versus anything that has to do with, you know, thyroid or metabolism. And you haven't been diagnosed with any other autoimmune conditions other than Raynaud's?
No. The Raynaud's could possibly be secondary or part of like scleroderma. Yeah. So I do see a rheumatologist. I mean, and I wouldn't fit a study on scleroderma. Like I don't fit the textbook description of it, but there's a lot of overlap. So she's kind of somewhat treating it like it is that, which there really isn't a lot of treatment, monitor, take care of symptoms. She's tried vasodilators like sildenafil, a Viagra, but my blood pressure is already really pretty low, and that lowered it more. She's wanted to try then a calcium channel blocker, which I haven't yet since I've been doing all the other supplements and AIP and all the other changes. I didn't want to try that. It also has a high chance of lowering my blood pressure before I could get to a dose that would be therapeutic for the Raynaud's.
Yeah.
And it's really just treating the symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The gut microbiome is obviously, you know, some people wish they had more of a microbiome that is more conducive to weight loss. And some people wish, you know, they wish they had more of a thrifty microbiome. You don't necessarily want to eat all the things that shifts it into a the negative direction, right? Once you've done all this work. But something in the microbiome could certainly be playing a role. Nutrient malabsorption, but you're taking the enzymes and HCL, and that's not, hasn't shifted anything, you know, into the.
I think it has with some gut stuff. Like I've had gut improvements,
right? But with weight,
this last 6-7 months, but not with weight, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I'm wondering about the calorie. Like everyone, I mean, after all the blood work and eliminating all the you know, really bad thing, the disease type of things that it could be, and no one really having an answer. It's just, you know, eat more calories and you're on a restrictive diet. You're probably not eating as much as you think. And that's, you know, I'm not having all the like tortilla chips and corn tortillas and, you know, sides of bread. And even, I mean, it used to be homemade rolls and, you know, what I thought was decent quality fillers, but that are, were just sort of fillers at meals, you know, a lot more chips, and that I'm not having now, even if I think my plate is very full and, you know, 1/2 pound of meat with a large serving of vegetables and some kind of, you know, rice or grain, maybe those empty calories did make up for more than I thought they did as far as just calorie intake.
Yeah, it's possible. One thing you could do is go back to, you know, a food journal.
I still have been.
Oh, you're doing it. Okay. Sorry. I didn't.
Yeah. I kind of like it now.
Yeah. It's kind of nice sometimes. You could consider, adding pictures to a couple of days just so I can get an idea of like, unless you're like pretty good about knowing exactly how much you're eating as far as like, you know, cups and ounces and grams and stuff like that. Sometimes just me seeing a picture of your plate, and maybe, you know, you put a picture of your hand in there so I can have a decent kind of, way to, you know, to compare. That might be something that we just at least check it off check it off the list as far as potential culprits and make sure that you are truly eating enough. And some people need more calories, in which case we're just going to have to try to find ways to squeeze more calories in. But what I'll do is, and if you want to do the photos, I'll wait. But I'll go back, you know, and look through your journal to see if anything obvious pops up. The other thing would be to take a couple of days to a week and log in something like Chronometer or some other logging, free logging app. And that takes a little bit extra on your end. You don't have to be super exact, you know, but if you can approximate, well, it was 1/2 pound of meat that I'm eating here. That's great. And that way we can actually get like a calorie amount. We can see what you're getting from a macronutrient and micronutrient perspective. So, I think that one or both of those things, you're already doing logging, but either, you know, including the pictures of what you're eating and, or, you know, logging in Chronometer for 5 to 7 days could be really enlightening.
Sure.
Yeah. That's actually, to be honest, one of the only times I usually recommend logging food, is when I think someone's maybe not eating enough and it's like, well, I feel like I'm eating all this volume. And then you're eating, you know, however many calories it is. And that may not be the case for you, but it would at least, like I said, allow us to check the calorie culprit off the list.
One of the snack suggestions you had mentioned was a coconut milk smoothie. And I had a question about that too. We talked a while ago about regular large quantities of coconut milk or any saturated fat maybe being detrimental to gut microbiome.
Yeah. Hard to say. It's going to be different for everyone. What I usually have people do is like a concentrated coconut milk in the can, is like, I wouldn't have you put all of that into a smoothie for like the full amount of your liquid. I would probably say, you know, do like 1/4 of a cup and then the rest fill with almond milk or water or, you know, cow milk or whatever you want. Just because a lot of people don't do well with very large quantities of like, you know, straight coconut milk. So it's still a good way to boost calories, but I wouldn't use it for all of the liquid base.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And you can, you know, you could do some coconut milk. You could do higher carbohydrate fruit, like banana or mango or pineapple, stuff like that. Could add a couple spoonfuls of nut butter in there. You could do a couple spoonfuls of yogurt, full fat yogurts, half an avocado, like scoop of protein powder. That's going to be a pretty big, bang for your buck smoothie when it comes to the calories and also the nutrients. The only thing I would caution with liquid calories is just to make sure that you are kind of, almost treating it like a meal versus chugging it and taking in 700 calories in 5 minutes. Kind of treat it like, you know, you're eating over the course of 20 minutes or 30 minutes, just because your digestive system probably isn't used to having all of that, those calories coming in within a very short period of time.
Okay, thank you. I'll check out that app. You said Chromometer?
Chrono. C is it C-H or C-R? Hold on. C-R-O-N-O-M-E-T-E-R. It's the best kind of free tracking app that I found.
And
I like it because it does micronutrients as well. So we can see if you have any nutritional holes, which you probably won't given your diet, but they will show up if you have any.
Okay. I've just kind of lazily not been wanting to go down the tracking app or tracking route, but
I know.
Probably should at this point. If it's only a week or so.
Yeah. No more than a week. You don't need anything more than a week. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's start there, and then, you know, you could track with and without the smoothie if you want to. I would definitely say track without, and then if you want to, you know, make a smoothie and see actually how many calories you're able to get within a smoothie, that might be a fun experiment as well. You can, with Chronometer, like, you can create recipes. So if you have the same kind of smoothie every day, you can just put it in there versus putting every single ingredient in every single day. But I would say let's start there, and then I'll think of other things we can explore if anything comes to mind. Yeah.
And I am the next couple of weekends and extra long weekend with the 4th of July, but I'm out of town and traveling, which I think I do pretty darn good considering it's camping and traveling, of still getting in, you know, high quality vegetables and still trying to be as well-rounded as I can, but it's not really the typical day-to-day diet when I'm camping or out with, you know, people traveling.
Yeah.
Point to start tracking.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say if you can track kind of what you've been doing, generally speaking, that's going to probably give us the best data versus trying to track when things are, you know, are not as they usually are from a food perspective. But yeah, I would say, you know, enjoy your camping, enjoy your vacationing, and don't worry too much about what you're eating if you're doing the best you can. Yeah. Sorry about that barking puppy earlier.
That's okay.
Anything else from either of you? No?
No.
No. Okay. Thank you.
Of course. It was great to have you both here. And we'll be back next week.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Have a nice day.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.